If everybody, please, just don't walk in front of the speaker. I know I said it once, but I'm saying it again, so thanks. All right, it gives me great pleasure. I'm so excited, and we're truly lucky to have Michael from Los Angeles here.
Hi. I'm Michael Hayes. I'm an alcoholic. And I think in this group, you guys talk about, in the format, you talk about anonymity and not identifying anybody by both their names, by first name only. And in my group, people never identify anybody else by both names. They only refer to people as their first name and last initial. But we introduce ourselves as our full name often. Many of us do. Some don't. Most do. And I just felt like acknowledging that because I've been to a lot of AA meetings all over, literally all over the world, actually. And the only time I've ever seen it in the preamble or the format is here, and I love that. And anonymity is the spiritual foundation of our program, and I know that I don't fully get that. I only get that a little bit, but I've talked to old timers who can go on and on about how profound a thing that is. Anonymity, probably the spiritual principle of anonymity in this program probably saved my life. Because when I got here, I was like, I had all sorts of opinions about what Alcoholics Anonymous is and was. And I don't know, probably 90% of them turned out not to be true. And one of the main things was that I never wanted to be known as an alcoholic in my community. And I didn't think that that would be possible going to Alcoholics Anonymous, even with the name Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, just wanted to say that. My sobriety date is March 17th, 1995. I have a sponsor. My sponsor's name is David B. And I have a home group. It's the Pacific Group. And when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me, get a sobriety date, get a sponsor, and get a home group. And I did. And it's worked so far. And so I always say that when I share from the front of the room. So I was born and raised in Los Angeles. I was the first child of my parents, and I was the first grandchild of both sets of grandparents. So I have a supreme sense of entitlement. I'll share about that. We'll be hearing about that. But, I grew up in L.A. in the 60s. I grew up in Laurel Canyon. Some people have heard of Laurel Canyon, I'm sure. There's a lot of stories about Laurel Canyon. It was crazy. It was wild, very wild in Laurel Canyon. I remember, being a little kid, and I always knew when the Hells Angels were coming into town, into my neighborhood. They had a couple houses that they hung out in up in the hills above my house, and I could hear them from far away, and I practically hid under the bed. The Manson murders happened when I was 7 years old. That one of them happened about 2 miles that side of my house. The other one happened about 2 miles that side of my house. And for some reason, I was very aware of it. My father was a Roman Catholic insurance salesman. They don't come much more straight than my dad. And my mom was a housewife. And they both grew up in really conservative Catholic communities. And for some reason, they moved to Laurel Canyon. And to this day, I don't know why. My mom can't explain it. My dad didn't really like it there. We lived there for 15 years or something like that. And it was wild. I grew up across the street from Jane Fonda. And next door to me was this guy who was kind of this famous hippie, really. And he would have, on any given afternoon, there'd be like 25 to 50 people hanging out by his pool. And they were, it was 1967, 68, 69, 70, in that era. And they were wild. They were doing whatever they wanted to do. And across the street from them was the Spiegelmans, and he was a famous psychoanalyst. And one way that I sum up my little neighborhood is that the kid I grew up across the street from, Jeff, he was going to have his bar mitzvah. And there were lots and lots of preparations for the bar mitzvah. And Jeff's house was just above Severin's house, the hippie that I lived next door to. And his front yard looked over into Severin's backyard and the pool in the backyard. And Severin was kind of like an obscure actor, but he was very well known in Hollywood. And, you know, I've actually seen him written about in books and stuff like that. But the bar mitzvah had invited like 300 people, and it was all going to be on the front lawn in their house, which overlooked Severin's pool. And I remember the day of the bar mitzvah, they were setting up for the bar mitzvah, and all these trucks started to arrive in the neighborhood, and I knew that there was something not quite right, and they were big trucks, and they started unloading the trucks and taking them into Severin's backyard, and it turned out that Severin had told a director friend of his that he could shoot a scene in his pool. And so Jeff's family just sort of rolled with it, and the guests started to arrive. They started to film in the pool, and it turns out that the scene that the director was filming in the pool was an orgy in the pool. So all 300 people at the bar mitzvah did nothing but stand and watch the filming. And I remember going back and forth from both, and you know, that was a sort of a dramatic example, but that was kind of like what my childhood was like. My parents, totally straight, totally conservative. The neighborhood, wild and crazy. You never knew what was going to happen from one day to the next. I went to a Catholic school growing up, and, you know, I was never for want of anything. My family wasn't super rich. We certainly weren't poor. I started to drink early, you know. I actually had my first drink when I was like 4 years old. I certainly didn't drink alcoholically then. I used to take sips off my dad and my uncle's beer. My dad was sort of this notorious drinker in high school and college. All of his friends talked about that all the time. My parents had a lot of parties of their own. So I sort of idolized my father, and part of idolizing my father was idolizing his drinking. So I didn't start drinking alcoholically until probably 13 and a half, 14, something like that. I started drinking daily when I was about 14 years old. You know, it was crazy in my household when I was growing up. My dad was a rager. My mom was a rager at that time too. My mom had six kids. My parents had six kids by the time I was 14 years old, and you know, she had five kids by 1971, and you know, she was 30 years old, and the scene in Los Angeles was just nuts. I mean, all the time. And so I look back on my parents raising six little kids in that era, in that place, and you know, my heart goes out to them, really, is what it comes down to. But you know, there was nothing about my parents, nothing about my upbringing, nothing about my childhood that makes me an alcoholic. Not even, there's a lot of evidence that there's been alcoholism on both sides of my family going back like many generations on both sides of the family. And I have lots of stories about that. But the point I want to make is that none of that is what makes me an alcoholic. I don't know if there's a hereditary element to this disease. It seems like there is. There are studies that say that there is, but I don't know that for sure. The only thing that I know for sure that makes me an alcoholic is that I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. And the way it says it in the big book is an alcoholic has an allergy of the body, coupled with an obsession of the mind and a spiritual malady. And for me, I've come to believe that spiritual malady, like I have a spiritual illness that underlies everything that I am and everything that I do in life, and I've come to know that as alcoholism. And that spiritual malady, it gives rise to a lot of different things, but the thing that I became really clear about at a certain point, and until I was clear about it, my life was one way, and all of a sudden it was a completely different way when I became clear about it, and that is that I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. So, you know, at 13 I started drinking pretty heavily. I remember one of the first times I got really drunk, I was wrestling with a friend, and we were rolling around on his living room floor just being idiots and, you know, probably pretending we were drunk more than we were actually drunk. But I was on my back, and he took his hand, and he just let it fall, and it fell right in my mouth. And I remember something changed as soon as it hit my mouth, and I spit something out, and I'll never forget seeing my whole tooth, like root and all, just spinning through the air and falling down, landing on my mouth. And we didn't do anything about it. I just put the tooth in my pocket. I checked it out in the mirror. It was kind of cool. I felt like a hockey player or whatever. I spent the night at his house, and the next afternoon I got home to my parents' house, and my mom was like, what? How? You know, my mom freaked out, you know. And so emergency call to the dentist. I'm in the dentist's office. They take the tooth. They stick it back in. And that was really the first consequence that I remember of my drinking. And, you know, a couple years later playing high school football, that tooth got knocked out again. And I remember being on the football field. I'm like, oh, there goes that tooth. And I just spit it out on the ground and kept going. You know, the next day the dentist fit me for like a retainer that had a replica basically of the tooth on it. And I put that in my mouth and away I went. I remember being at a party not long after that. And when I went to the bathroom, and, you know, and when you're like 14 or 15 years old, you know, smiling with a big blank space in your mouth, like, you know, it doesn't do a lot for that already discomforted adolescence, you know. So I go to the bathroom, I look in the mirror, and I smile, and I, like, the tooth is gone, and I'm really, really drunk. And I remember, oh, yeah, I threw up at the parking lot in the donut shop. So I go back to my friends. I beg my friends to take me back to the donut shop as fast as possible. We go back to the donut shop. I go, I find, you know, and I, like, reach over, and I just, like, pick it up, brush it off, stick it back in my mouth, and off I go, you know? And, you know, that's, like, that's how we rolled, you know? That's how we did it. And what I found was, you know, like, for me, in my early drinking, there was some peer pressure, and sometimes, you know, I drank really hard just for the look of it, you know. You know, I wasn't really a blackout drinker ever in my career. There were a couple times that I blacked out. I didn't really throw up much. It was all about this macho thing. It was sort of like trying to appeal to my father and his friends, and at that point, by the way, you know, it was like my father's worst nightmare that I was drinking. So I drank really hard and got crazy, but really I was the kind of alcoholic, I just like to take the edge off. But I always like to have the edge off. And it took a lot for me to get the edge off. So I drank a lot, and I didn't really hang out with people that didn't drink like I drank. Like, if you couldn't really hang with us, then you couldn't hang with us. And that was sort of a macho thing too. You know, we felt like we were some sort of elite drinkers. And just for the record, you know, a huge part of my story is that I did a lot of drugs. I started doing psychedelics at a very young age. I did a lot of psychedelics. We can talk after the meeting if you want. I'll give you lots of details of that. I started doing many, many other drugs. Most drugs that you can name, I did in the early part of my drinking and using. And some of those stayed with me a long, long time. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know you guys like to respect Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to respect Alcoholics Anonymous. But I do believe that drugs are a big part of our alcoholic stories. And so I like to mention that. It's important that people be able to identify in here. And so I just want to acknowledge that. But in the early part of my drinking, I drank really hard, and a lot of that was for show. But after there was nobody there to see, I was still drinking really, really hard. And this went on for years and years and years. You know, I got into college. I don't know how I got into college. You know, I guess I had a cultural predisposition towards doing well enough in school to get by. It wasn't really anything that I applied because, you know, really the only good grades I ever got were from cheating, maybe sheer luck. And, you know, I know that I was bright. I have a good mind, but I was just bright enough to be able to skate from any of the consequences that of my drinking, with the only exception being that tooth. You know, I could, there were numerous, whenever me and my friends were confronted by the cops, they would try to push me to the front, have me talk to the cops, and it always worked. Whenever I talked to the cops, we got out of whatever we were into. Nobody ever got arrested around me. I was, you know, I had that gift, and I was, you know, I got to college. I didn't really try, but I loved school, and I loved studying. But the thing that I loved about school is that there was nobody there to watch me. There, I had no checks and balances at school. I could drink exactly the way I wanted all the time. And somehow I was able to study a little bit and get through college, but my drinking was getting worse and worse and worse. I got out of college. I moved to the Bay Area. I went to work in rock and roll. You know, by the time I got to that business, the heyday had kind of passed. I wasn't really, you know, people that were drinking and using like I was were frowned upon for the most part, except for those few secret people that kind of kept it on the down low. And I loved that. I didn't like anybody to know about it. You know, and that sense of entitlement that I talked about, that, you know, made me an exception to everything. And that's part of my spiritual malady. That's part of my spiritual illness of alcoholism. I have this thing that tells me that I can do whatever I want, whenever I want. And I will tell you whatever I think you need to hear to make it so that I can do that. And, you know, the lies got more and more elaborate. They got more and more constant. They got harder and harder to track. But for some reason, you know, and this worked against me, I felt like I was really good at tracking my lies. And I was a really, really evil liar. Like, I could tell you exactly what you wanted to hear. I could play on your heartstrings. I wasn't afraid to say anything I needed to say. I wasn't afraid to manipulate you in any way to get what I thought I wanted. And, you know, really, that's probably the thing that almost killed me. I remember being in the dean's office. He caught us red-handed smoking pot, and I managed to convince the dean of my high school that he didn't see what he saw. He was a cop too. He said, "Why are you smoking?" I said, "There's no way I would smoke pot. I was not smoking pot. We were not smoking pot. My only chance for getting in college is if I get a scholarship to play football, and I can't put that at risk." And I knew that he loved football. I knew that he loved sports, and I played the good American kid for him, and it worked. And there was not any consequence to getting caught for smoking pot for me or any of the other people that were with us. So, you know, I was working in rock and roll. One time I built stages was one of the things that I did when I worked in rock and roll, and one of the first moments of clarity that I had, one of the first senses that I got that things were out of balance was I didn't exactly come to, like I was aware, I wasn't in a total blackout, but I was close, and I was 60 feet in the air putting together, you know, I was on a scaffolding that held speakers, and I was wiring some speakers 60 feet in the air. And then all of a sudden, I was like, I had been partying all night long. I'd really been partying for a couple days at that point. And it was maybe more a moment of clarity than coming to, but it felt like I was asleep up there. And then all of a sudden, I was awake, and I just realized, holy what am I doing here? I could easily fall out of the scaffolding. I have nothing. I had a harness on, but I wasn't using it because I didn't need a harness. I wasn't going to fall or die. I was an exception to every rule, including that one. And in that moment, I sort of realized, you know, I'm not sure that I can keep living the way that I'm living. I probably need to smoke less pot, or I probably need to cut back on, I need to get more sleep, you know, something like that I told myself. And I remember I drank the rest of that day, all day long. I really ran the wheels off. I lived an outlaw lifestyle. I had always had straight jobs, but at the same time, I always had illegal jobs too, and I made sure that that I protected myself. I saw a lot of people get into a lot of trouble for that. I sort of have a little bit of survivor's complex. I did not get in trouble for that, except that I put my life in more and more danger doing that. And I impacted a lot of other people's lives doing that. And I've had to make amends for that. And I actually have living amends that I've been making for that ever since I did my ninth step. But I stopped being able to do that. I stopped being able to show up for work. I started sleeping on more and more friends' couches. The wheels started to come off. I started doing geographics. I moved to Portland, Oregon. I moved to L.A. I moved back from L.A. I started to realize that I didn't want to drink the way I was drinking. I wanted to slow down a little bit, so I started to do more controlled drinking, which I talked about in the big book, and I never, ever had any success at that. If I took one drink, I was off and running. Incomprehensible demoralization it talks about in the big book happened for me in the countless times I tried to slow down my drinking, and one more time found myself up at sunrise, wondering how I got there, totally, completely, just dejected, just demoralized. That's the only word I have for it. And so all of a sudden I became convinced that if I was going to get, I actually started doing outpatient programs. My dad got sober in that time, in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was sober a couple of years, and I was visiting L.A. I wasn't living there at the time, and my dad gave me a big book. And I was like, are you kidding me? What is, like, I know that I've got some problems and that I haven't exactly lived a real great example of a life, but an alcoholic, I know my dad needed Alcoholics Anonymous desperately. He was ruining his family, he was losing his job, so on and so forth, but, But I kept the big book, and that big book kept turning up every time I moved. And I would see that damn big book, and I'd hear my dad talking to me. And my dad was really, really great about it, too. He said, I want to give you this. You may need it. I don't know for sure that you do, but I want you to have it. And that's all he said. And a couple years later, I woke up on a friend's living room floor. I didn't have a place to live at that time. I was, like, between geographics, where I was one constant geographic at that point. And I remember there was an NFL playoff game going on, and I woke up, and it was the middle of the game, and all these people had come over to the house that I was sleeping on the floor of to watch the game. I'm right there in the middle of the living room, and most of the people I know, and I was kind of upset that they didn't wake me up to get me out of the way, and they told me they tried to wake me up and that I wouldn't wake up, and that was kind of that was an insulting, embarrassing moment for me, and I started to believe that I had a problem. I still didn't believe it was drinking at all. I just felt like I needed to learn how to control it better. I started trying to figure out where I could go to do that. It never even crossed my mind to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I started doing these outpatient programs, and I started doing, talking to people, reading self-help books. Then it got worse and worse, and I started to swear it off. And I decided, I got to stop, and I couldn't stop, and I couldn't stop, and I couldn't stop. And then I went to a couple more outpatient programs. I went to a couple of inpatient rehabs, got exposed to the big book and a little bit of Alcoholics Anonymous in those programs, but nothing really had an impact. And usually one or two days after I got out of those programs, I'd be drinking again. And I became convinced that I wasn't going to be able to get well until I came clean to my parents about what my life really was. Ironically enough, my dad had already given me the big book. They knew exactly what was going on with me. I thought that I had some secret. They knew exactly what it was. And so I started to believe that I needed to move back to Los Angeles and go be around them and tell them what my life was really like. And I had a lot of shame about that. My parents are people that would never have considered themselves the kind of people that would have had the kind of son that I really was. And so I moved to L.A., and I tried to live a couple places. I couldn't make it work. I ended up moving into my parents' house at the age of 32. It was, talk about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That was definitely it. I left home when I was 15, really, and moved in with my grandmother because I could basically drink like I liked to drink. And then I left her house at 17. I was on my own from the time I was 13, 14, something like that. And I had done okay for myself from time to time, but never really able to keep it together. And I was constantly trying to avoid any kind of accountability because if you didn't know who I really was, then, you know, if you couldn't get that I deserved what I wanted, then I just basically didn't interact with you anymore. So I got back to my, so I got to my parents' house. It took me 8 months. Those 8 months were hell, but I did finally go to my parents and say, you know what, I've got to talk to you. I got to tell you what's really going on in my life. I met with them later that night, and I explained to them, you know, what I was really doing, what my real problems were, and they knew I had problems, but they didn't know what the details were, and they were pretty aghast. And I, you know, I'm just going to say this the way it was said to me. My dad looked up from across his desk after I told him what was really going on, and he goes, even with his 8 years of experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, he looked at me and said, "You got to knock that shit off." You know, and you know, like, why didn't I think? Oh, thank you, you know, and you know, so my dad started taking me to AA meetings. You know, he said, "Do you want to go to a meeting?" And I said, "Yes," and it really was that simple. And my dad was really kind of my Eskimo, and he never tried to get me to stop, but he offered to take me to meetings, and I went with them. And then I started going to meetings on my own. I did another inpatient program. And by the way, in that inpatient program, in that rehab, I got my first principle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got my first real spiritual principle, which is one day at a time. And I didn't fully grasp it. I didn't fully get it. But I got enough to know that if I was going to try to stay sober, I only had to stay sober for a day. I didn't have to stay sober for a week or a year or the rest of my life. And as a matter of fact, if I tried to do that, it would make it harder for me to stay sober for that one day. I got that in that rehab. And I got out of that rehab and I drank 2 days later. You know, it was the same old story. And my life spiraled even farther downward. My mom, I was living with them, like I said. My mom told my dad, you know, "You got to get him out of here." And my dad was like, "There's no way I'm kicking him out. He's my son. He's been loyal to me. I'm going to be loyal to him." And my mom said, "Okay, either he goes or you both go. What's it going to be?" And my dad was like, you know, 3 minutes later talking to me, "You're out of here." And, you know, like, so I like, bullshitted them and, excuse me, you know, I just, like, kept fudging it, and lying to them, and demoralizing them more and more, and splitting them apart, and playing them against each other, and playing my brothers and sisters against my parents and against each other. It was hell. And my mom finally called the sheriff, and she said, "What does it take to get somebody, my son, removed from my own house? Can I do that? Is that legal?" Just so happens that the guy she got on the phone was a sheriff's deputy who that week had his own son, who had very similar problems as me, removed from his house. And they made very fast friends. I actually overheard the conversation. I couldn't tell what it was, but I kind of pieced it together while I was, you know, listening from around the corner of my mom's room. And, you know, they bonded. And the guy tells her, "Listen, the moment you want him out of your house, you call me at this number. I personally will come remove him from your house." You know, and so she hangs up the phone. She comes and tells me that. I knew the jig was up. You know, I'll just tell you this one thing about me and my mom. Like, my mom saved my life, right? And I was the kind of alcoholic, like, my sense of entitlement allowed me to steal from anybody. It allowed me to do anything I wanted to do anytime I wanted to do it. One day while I was living with them in that period, I came home, and I was out of money, and I stole money all the time, and I stole money from my parents. I stole money for, you know, I just was a thief. I see my mom's purse sitting on the counter. I see my mom out in the backyard. There's no way she can see me. I open her wallet. I take money out of the wallet, put it in my pocket, and go out in the backyard. "Hey, Mom, how's it going? Good to see you," you know. And my mom's, "Hi, how are you?" Very sweet to me, you know. And she comes in the house, and I notice her look at her purse, and then I skedaddle. And she calls me a couple minutes later. "Mike, we come downstairs." I come downstairs. There's her purse. There's her wallet. She's got the money left in her wallet spread out. And she says, "20 minutes ago, I counted my money in my wallet, and there was twice as much money as is in there now. Where is the money?" I was like, "What are you talking about? I didn't take your money. I could never take your money. You mean everything to me." You know, it's really pathetic. And then, you know, I offered to help look around the house for it, and we did, you know. I'm that kind of alcoholic. I'm going to steal from you, I'm going to help you find what I stole, you know. And, you know, and she played along with the charade for like 30 seconds. She was just like, stop. Give me the money back, and we won't talk about it for one more second. And, you know, and I did. I gave her the money back. And that was kind of a moment of clarity right there, too. That was like a little surrender. I was starting to get it a little bit. And you know, she has said that I got to be out, and I know I got to be out. It's later that day. I don't have a job, of course. I go to a meeting. I'm on the steps of the meeting, and I see this guy that I had drank with for years and years and years. And you know, the last time I had seen him, he had like an open bullet wound in his leg, and there were hookers around. He had an Uzi, and you know, and a Glock. I mean, this guy was the real deal. And now I see him on the steps of this meeting, and he's like tan. He has color in his face. He looks great. He looks awesome. And I'm like, what happened to you? And he looks back at me and he says, we'll get to that later. I think the more important thing right now is what happened to you? And it was probably true. I looked like death warmed over, I'm sure. And he explained to me that he had gone to this recovery house and that the recovery house was based on the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and that they let him in there. And I said, I don't have any money. And he said, they worked that out with me too. And he says, if you want to go there and meet the manager, I'll arrange that. And he gave me a phone number. I called that phone number later that day. He said he had arranged it with the manager for me to come the next day. I did. Of course, I went and got loaded first. I was a half an hour late. You know, I got there and this guy starts telling me my story. Like, he starts telling me exactly how I felt, exactly what I had been going through. I was kind of blown away, giving me goosebumps to this moment. And he says, if you want to come in this house and you're willing to surrender here, because that's what we do here, we surrender. And I had no idea what that meant. But he said, that's what we do. I could tell it was something serious. I could tell my life was about to change. I was desperate. I'd been to the hospital 4 times. Twice I was revived. I'd go to the hospital unable to breathe. I had coated my lungs with tar with my alcoholism. And you know, like I was beat. I was exhausted, and I didn't think that I was going to be lucky enough to die. I thought I was just going to go on and on and on. I didn't have the balls to kill myself, and I'd been on death's door a number of times and come back, and maybe it was my arrogance, maybe it was whatever it was. True or not, I just felt like I wasn't going to be lucky enough to die, and I wanted out. And so this was one more chance to get out, and I said, okay. This manager of this house called my parents, told them about the house and made arrangements for me to move in there the next day. I went and got loaded. My brother drove me to the place that morning, and I haven't had a drink or a drug since that morning. And I moved into that house, and they detoxed me. And I had kicked many, many times. I had had the DTs. I had had lots of consequences, for physical consequences for my drinking, but I never had anything like this. And they took incredible care of me. You know, they would feed me if I was even able to eat. They would take me and they would drag me to the shower for a couple of, you know, for like a week. I couldn't really even, they would take me to the shower, lean me against the shower wall, turn the water on, let me slide down to the floor and just run the water on me for 15 minutes. And that felt so good, you know, and it was like, and I had some sort of spiritual experience in that shower on one of those days. And, you know, I won't go into the details of it, but it meant that I was going to, that I might have a chance is the bottom line. And so I remember going to my first sober meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous after I was detoxed. I was so sick. I was terribly, terribly sick, and I was coughing and sneezing, and I was sitting next to these members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were just like, you know, I was gross. I was disgusting, and I will never forget this. I was coughing uncontrollably, and I remember this woman sitting next to me. She took her palm, and she put it on the small of my back, and she just rubbed my back, and it was so gentle, and I have never forgotten that moment. It was just like, you know, now I look at it like that was the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous reaching out and telling me that if I stuck around, wow, if I stuck around, I might be okay. That woman, I see that woman every once in a while. God, I have told this story many, many times. I haven't been moved like this. But, you know, I started to do what they asked me to do in that recovery house. And basically what that recovery house was one giant lesson in humility. I had to tell Every night at dinner, we had a meeting, and every member of the House had to say what they were doing, like, hour to hour the next day. And if you varied from that plan, there was a consequence. I had to be responsible for making my bed, for putting the cap on the toothpaste after I brushed my teeth, for being honest, you know, and, like, I couldn't be honest at first. And I lied all the time at the beginning, but I got, like, there were consequences to that. I'd lose some privilege or another. And through those consequences and through the willingness to subject myself to that, I kept getting humbled over and over and over again. And I started to become true to something that I didn't even know what it was exactly, but I could tell that it was making me well. And I could tell that if I kept doing it a day at a time, if I kept doing it a little bit more, if I kept trying at it, that I might have a chance of surviving myself. So I did that, and, you know, and the guy who owned the house and ran that house was from Philadelphia. He was the child of mob parents, and he was a bad-ass mofo. I am not kidding, okay? And he ran these groups. He was an incredible man. He ran these groups. He was 20 years sober at this time, and he would have a group for the house members once a week and a group for the family members with the house members once a week. And I was, you know, my arrogance was nowhere near gone. My arrogance isn't gone to this day, you know, like, but I have tools for it. And at that time, I didn't really know that I had tools for it. And I remember being in a family group, and he said a couple of things, and I didn't like the way he said them, so I turned that group on him. For some reason, I knew that I had credibility with the parents, and I got those parents to believe that he was ripping them off. And a revolt happened in that group, and I'll never forget being in the garage smoking a cigarette after that group, and he walks out there, and he's just like, he's smoking a cigarette, and he doesn't say anything. He just looks up at me, and he goes, "You have no idea what you've done." And here's the thing about that. Yeah, and I was scared. You know, I'm a white boy from Laurel Canyon. This guy could have, you know, anyway. But he didn't throw me away. And I used to cause major commotion and drama in that house all the time. My anger had been medicated by alcohol. And all of a sudden, all that, I had no tool to deal with my anger until I got to that house. But for a while, my anger, you know, they would talk about, oh no, his veins are popping out of his neck. The thing, his head is there. Apparently, when I get angry, something happens in my, yeah, some people, they would know before I would know, and they'd like, you know, there would be, and I caused fights in the house, and they never threw me away. And it saved my life. And I got a sponsor in that house. I started to work the steps. They had us going to meetings. I went to two meetings a day, really, probably for the first 8 or 9 months of my sobriety. And, you know, I started to hear things in those meetings. I started to hear that if I was willing to grow, and then willing to grow spiritually one day at a time, that I could probably continue to stay sober if I focused on what I needed to do in a given day. And that really stuck with me, and it stuck with me from the beginning. I really got the sense that I needed to continue to grow if I was going to stay sober over the long haul. And that serves me very well to this day. And I also got that I was going to have to be of service. That my head wants to kill me. The manifestation of my disease of alcoholism, of my spiritual malady, is that my head wants to kill me. And that an antidote to that is being of service. And that was a big part of being in that house, is that we had to be of service. We had to take care of ourselves, and we had to take care of our brothers. We were told we are our brother's keeper. And that saved my life. And the principles that I learned in that house, like humility, being of service, and a willingness to grow spiritually, which on any given day could and still does, still could mean anything, practically. Some days it looks like holding the door for somebody. Some days it looks like, you know, turning myself into the IRS or something, you know. Like, you know, I want to say the FBI, but I haven't had to turn myself into the FBI. I don't think I've done anything that I... Not since I've been sober that I need it. So anyway, you know, it can look different any given day. And you know, I've had incredible experiences being sober. But one thing that I've constantly had to contend with is my own sense of entitlement, my own arrogance. And you know, in any given job I'm on, like, you know, if you don't understand why you need to do it my way, you probably need to go do it somewhere else. You know, and I also had this other thing. It was like, You know, I can't say it exactly the way I'd like to say it, but it's like a syndrome. Like, I had to be the big guy on the job, you know? And, like, and the irony is that a lot of people look at me that way anyway. And I do have some leadership skills. But because I was about me and because I was about being recognized for some egotistical thing, whatever I had to offer got lost in that. And in the last few years, I started to lose jobs. And I went and got a new job. And I went and got a new career. And in that new job, I had this boss who was just like a complete jerk to me all the time. And slowly but surely, I started to realize that those were some of the things that I was hearing and from doing the step work well into sobriety that I was hearing were character defects of mine. And I started to be able to step back from it a little bit. And I started to have some humility around my relationship with that boss and my relationship to my boss, I mean to my job and the people that I worked with. And I surrendered. And I just let him do what he did. And it was one of the biggest surrenders I've ever made in my life. About a year ago, that boss came to me and said that he had singled me out to make my life miserable and harass me. And I was like, what? And he said that he had had some sort of spiritual thing. You know, I actually, you know, this is a self-diagnosed disease, but he may be an untreated one of us, but he had some sort of spiritual thing that he said happened to him and that he needed to come to me and admit that. And I, like, it was one of the most humbling things that's ever happened to me in my life. And I was just like, thank you, let me know how I can help. And that guy's had flare-ups since then, but I have flare-ups all the time to my craziness too. And I have some compassion for him now. And we have a great relationship, and we've made some money together. And it's a very, very cool thing. So one thing that I, you know, in the last couple of minutes that I have the seventh step in the 12 and 12 talks about humility. It talks about the humility that we need to get sober in the first place. It talks about a couple other things that I want to talk about here real briefly. You know, one of the things about humility, it says in the 12 and 12, is that the world out there has no sense of the spiritual principle of humility. So when we are like at work and we're practicing our spiritual principles, people don't get it. You know, when we go to make amends to some coworker that we wronged, that really maybe we feel like they, you know, if you were me, it's really that I thought they wronged me and I was going to manipulate them by making amends and hope that they made them back or whatever, some insanity, whatever it was. But they, you know, when I really was practicing my spiritual principles, when I really am practicing my spiritual principles, there's no agreement for that in the world. You know, it makes it more of a challenge. And the other thing about humility is that, I can't remember the second thing about humility. One of the things about humility is being able to admit when I failed or when I'm wrong and, you know, being able to swallow my pride. And the stronger I get at that, the bigger the surrenders are that I have to make. It seems like it's never, ever going to end. And I'm starting to accept that. And, you know, I'm crazy. I am really crazy, and I'm hard to deal with. I'm a difficult person. But when I start applying the tools and the spiritual principles that I've got from this program, my life starts to work, and people start to be able to work with me. People actually every once in a while enjoy being around me. I can get stuff done, and I can survive my own deadly disease of alcoholism, and I can get out of my own head just long enough to be of service to somebody else sometimes. And that may be the biggest gift that I've gotten. I've had four friends die in the last 2 years who were, three of them were born in the same year I was born. All of them I knew longer than 30 years. All four of them, in my opinion, were alcoholics. A couple of them said they were alcoholics. They were all drinking and using when they died. And they were close to me. I realized, I was thinking about this a couple of weeks ago, I lived with each one of them at one point in my life for long periods of time. And, you know, if you're new and you get sober in here, you know, you're gonna become aware of some stuff that you probably weren't acknowledging before you got in here. And, you know, there's a passing parade that goes through here. And sometimes you just got to be able to say better them than me and be willing to be of service for them, you know. But people die. as alcoholics. It's a real disease. I probably don't need to tell you. I know, you know, there have been some things that happened around here in the not too distant past that maybe make that clear to people. But, you know, these are people that are really, really close to me. And I don't know what the difference is between me and them, to tell you the truth. I know there's a chapter in the big book that says how it works. And I know that since I've done that, it's made a difference for me. And if I continue to do that a day at a time, I stand a chance. But when it gets right down to it, I don't know what the difference is between the person who has the grace to have the willingness and the person who doesn't. So, you know, I know that I need to do every single thing I can for myself in here by serving you. And then the last thing I'll say is that my father died a couple years ago. I've told this story too. So I got up, I was asked to do his eulogy. And I can't tell you what an honor that was. And similar to now, I got up in front of that room and there were a lot of people there, and they were all the people that were like the most intimidating people in the world to me, my dad's friends, you know. And I started to speak and I was petrified when I got up there. And I was trying every trick in the book, you know, I got up in front of that room and I was like, and I started to talk and nothing came out. You know, and I just saw this look on people's faces like, this is why family members are not asked to do eulogies, right here. This is it. And then that moment, I was afraid I really wasn't going to be able to do it. And I remember that I got sober, and that if I got sober the way I was, I can pretty much do anything in the natural world, you know? And I realized that there were other alcoholics in that room, and I started to see them, like miraculously, I started to see them, and they were just smiling, and they were completely patient. And I got my presence of mind, and I was able to give that eulogy. And I was able to honor my father, who was an awesome guy. And he was my Eskimo. And my family has come to me over and over for help from me. And they trust me now. Like, I'm the executor of the numerous peoples in my family's will. I'm taking care of my uncle and all of his financial stuff right now with him, and he's trusted me to do that. He won't let anybody else do it. That's crazy to me. That's crazy to me. And he's a really, you know, as close to anybody is in the world to me. And somebody trusts me like that, that's a frickin' miracle. So I don't know what's going on that I'm standing up here bawling my eyes out in front of you guys, but I am, and it's okay, you know, I can do that now. Like, alcoholics is about real people talking about real stuff. If it's about anything, it's about that. So I'm very, very grateful. Thank you, Kristen. Thank you, Vicki. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous in Santa Maria. I'm just going to say this. You know, I come from the Pacific Group. I wanted to share a couple things about the Pacific Group tonight. You know, it has saved my life in sobriety. It's an incredible thing. And I'm telling you guys that they don't have anything. We don't have anything in the Pacific Group that you guys don't have here. All the Pacific Group is a structure for sober alcoholics to get by and fulfill our primary purpose, which is to stay sober and help another alcoholic. You guys have that here, man. You don't ever question that. It's the sobriety in Santa Maria at Alcoholics Anonymous is awesome. Thank you very much.